Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the political brain with Emory Professor Drew Weston. With the political season upon us, it seemed a good time to bring in a local gem, a local resource. Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry Drew Weston, who is also the author of the new book, The Political Brain. Much to the shock of an academic, Weston's book was reviewed almost everywhere and has received an extraordinary amount of attention, not what your typical academic psychologist expects. Continuing now my conversation with Emory Professor Drew Weston about his book, The Political Brain. So you wrote this book, you expected it would be remaindered shortly and that a few super political nerdy types would be calling you over the next decade, but in fact something else happened. What happened?
Well, what happened was, you know, I'd like to believe that, wow, this was like, you know, an amazing book and that's why it's kind of taken off. As a student of intellectual history, what I actually do know is that sometimes there's an idea that is waiting for someone to say it and to put it together in a particular way that people go, oh, geez, of course, that's obvious. And in some ways, that's what you really want as an author. You know, you want people to read your book and have the shock of recognition. You know, you want them to read it and go, oh, of course. And what has happened is I've gotten a lot of that, of course. And I was more worried in some ways because the book is actually, it's written from, I had a conflict about how to write it. I wanted to write it for a general audience, particularly for politically interested people, not just for other academics. But did I want to write it as a scientist describing how these processes happen and how does voting really work? Or did I want to write it as that, but also as a partisan who has young kids who is really concerned about the world that we're leaving our kids? And to tell you the truth, the reality was that the reason I wrote this book was not just because I wanted to write academic ideas about how the mind and brain work in politics, but what got me to write this book was that I couldn't stand what was happening in the world, and I have two young children, and I thought, I've got to do something about it. So I ended up writing a hybrid book that's a mixture of
description of the research and the findings.
You got it. And it is also a
Drew Weston's screed about the future of politics.
Well, you know,
and how it ought to be played out from your political perspective.
That's right. And what I'll sometimes, when I talk to bipartisan or I was going to say nonpartisan, there are no nonpartisan audiences in America anymore.
Like objective journalists. Yes.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, you find me some of them, and we'll talk in a couple of centuries. But when I talk to bipartisan audiences, what I'll typically say is, I've got good news and bad news for both of you. If you're a Republican, the good news is that you're about 40 years ahead of the Democrats in understanding how to talk to voters. If you're a Democrat, the good news is that I'm articulating some principles that actually might be helpful to you, because these are principles that are principles of effective communication. They're principles of how do you get your point across to people in a way that is emotionally compelling to them. And usually that actually starts with values. I mean, this is one of the things that Democrats do so badly is they hide their values in the fine print of their policies. You know, they'll give you their 16-point healthcare plan, but they'll never stop and say, why am I developing a healthcare plan? Why does this actually matter to you? Why should this matter to you? And they'll think that the reason it should matter to you is because you care about your healthcare. Well, you do care about your healthcare. But it turns out that if you actually study the way people vote, they vote not only on the basis of their self-interest. That does matter. That actually matters most when it converges with their values. And that most voters, you know, we have this idea that they're values voters, and that's associated with, you know, values like typically right-wing values or socially conservative values. The reality is that all of us are values voters. I was speaking in a multi-million-dollar townhouse in Greenwich Village last year, and I'll have to tell you the story about how I ended up there because it's actually kind of a fun story. It gets back to your question that as an academic, it's in my DNA to give 30-minute answers to 20-second questions. I've meandered far from your question. But I'm in this Greenwich Village townhouse, and I get the inevitable question, you know, what's the matter with Kansas? How come all those blue-collar workers, those laborers, are voting for people who are enacting tax cuts for the upper 2%? And my response was, well, I kind of look around the room at this beautiful place, and I say, well, what's the matter with you? know, you guys are Democratic donors, and you know, you're progressives. You're people who are donating lots of your hard-earned cash to people who want to take away the extra $112,000 tax break that you're getting on every $1 million that you earn this year. Is there something wrong with your brain? Are you like a neurology patient? And the reality is that the reason they were doing it, it's the same reason why that person in Kansas is doing it, that we're all values voters. We all care deeply about some things, and we vote for the people who we think are most likely to conduct the business of government in a way that fits with our values.
Yeah, folks in million-dollar townhouses in Greenwich Village probably aren't going to understand how someone in Kansas thinks.
No, that's true. And you know, if they're Democrats, they're more likely to assume that these people in Kansas are getting fooled. And that's why they're voting Republican. And, you know, there is an argument to be made that people can get fooled. I mean, people can get fooled. I don't think most people would have thought that George W. Bush would be the most spendthrift president in the history of the country. I mean, he said he was a conservative, and conservatives are supposed to be for fiscal responsibility. And who would have ever thought that a guy who said, I'm against nation building, we shouldn't have gone into Bosnia, you know, and we shouldn't have adventurous foreign policies, we should stick with America's interests. Who would ever thought this guy would be marching into Iraq and now talking about bombing Iran, and maybe we'll hit Qatar and the Arab Emirates for a little good measure there if we need to. But, you know, the point is that most of the time what Republicans do is they tell you up front what their values are, and they're honest about them. You know, you won't hear Republicans hedge on abortion. They'll tell you, I believe life begins at conception, no ifs, ands, or buts. If you ask them about guns, they'll say, I believe that people have the right to bear arms, and I believe that that right is sacred right. It's guaranteed in our Constitution. I don't care whether it's a bazooka or a handgun, but you got the right to bear arms. They'll say, I believe in a strong national defense. I believe in small government. But we know where Republicans stand. Take any one of those issues and ask, you know, where do Democrats stand?
Oh, like Michael Dukakis and the death penalty?
Yeah, well, that was a great example. That was a great example. Well, you know, that's actually a prototypical example, because watching that debate when Michael Dukakis was asked that question, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for her rapist? And Dukakis says, Bernard, I wouldn't. I think you know that I have opposed the death penalty my whole career. I don't see any evidence that it's an effective deterrent, and we have better, more effective ways to solve violent crime. We have done that in my state of Massachusetts, blah, 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 blah. And what's so striking about that answer is that he didn't understand the question he was being asked. That because he started with this whole, what in the back of most Democrats' minds as they are running campaigns as they are campaigning themselves, is this rationalistic vision of how the mind works. This vision of a dispassionate mind as the cool calculating machine that's calculating its rational self-interest. He heard the question as, what's the rational utility of the death penalty? Is it an effective deterrent?
Right, as opposed to hearing, hey, when your family's threatened, how would you act? And answering, you know, actually, I'd want to be the one to pull the switch on the electric chair on a personal level, but on a, you know, political level, I don't think it works or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or right. You know, the Tim Kaine, governor of Virginia, is actually an opponent of the death penalty. So he gets asked about this when he's running for governor about the death penalty. And Republicans are running against him, you know, this guy doesn't believe in the death penalty. So he gets on, he says, look, I'm a Catholic, and my faith tells me that this is a question that's best left to God. This is not a question that, life and death questions are not questions that we should be answering here on earth. You know, I know a lot of you don't agree with me on that one, but that's my faith. Well, boy, that's a hard one. That's a hard one to, you know, he understood that it was a values question.
Right.
And
right.
What Michael Dukakis didn't understand was that he was being asked, number one, are you a man?
Yeah.
Like, you know, do you have the normal feelings that a man has?
Right.
He asked, number two, do you have feelings at all? Because he'd kind of run as a Vulcan. You know, he'd run to replace Spock on
a very
Star Trek.
Short Vulcan.
In a tank.
Yeah. Oh, right. Snoopy. Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, the third question was, really that he was being asked was really the most important one, which is, do you have the kind of values that I have that means that you could faithfully represent me as my president?
Right.
And he didn't understand that that was the question he was being asked. Because if he'd understood that, he might have said something as simple as, like, I don't know, for example, if he was a secular person. He might not have any particular religious beliefs, or he might be a religious man. I have no idea. He was only the second person ever to run for president of the United States in the 20th century, and I believe in our history, who ended his convention address with some version of thank you very much, as opposed to God bless you all and God bless America. Walter Mondale had been the first in 1984 to ever do that. You look like, I believe there's a question.
We can have fun with talking about the specific cases forever, but you know, I want to get back to sort of what happened with the book. I mean, how many books did the publisher first print in the first printing?
8. 10? No, I'm not really sure, but I know that it went to the third printing by the second week.
How many books have been sold now?
You know, I don't know. If I start getting...
How many printings have there been?
We're in the third, and the third one has a really nice quote from Bill Clinton saying that you really ought to read this book.
You said something funny to me about what happened to your obscurity factor.
Yeah, you know, people have asked me a lot this last year about, you know, the book came out at the end of June, and have asked me about all the people I've been talking to and the campaigns I'm advising and that kind of stuff. And I like to say that I went from complete obscurity to relative obscurity in no time flat.
The book is The Political Brain. It's by Professor Drew Weston. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks very much for having me on.